Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning. Today we will hear the case 2023-40605, Texas Medical Association et al. Versus United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. We will hear first from Mr. Soder.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Kevin Soder from the Department of Justice for the government. At the outset, I think it might be helpful if I could just take about 3 minutes to address both the merits and the remedial issue. On the merits, to protect patients from ruinous surprise medical bills, Congress enacted the No Surprises Act. It required three government agencies, the defendants here, to issue regulations fleshing out some of the details of the methodology that would be used to calculate the qualifying payment amount, or QPA. It's a figure that Congress devised to essentially proxy for what the in-network cost of the medical services would have been. And for patients, the QPA can determine their cost-sharing responsibility, meaning how much they owe in terms of a copay, coinsurance, and a deductible. For insurers, Congress decided that there would be a negotiation and arbitration process to determine how much they would pay to the providers. And of course, for the medical providers, such as the plaintiffs here, their compensation for a given service is the sum of what they get from the patient and from the insurer. Congress expected the agencies to use their expressly delegated authority to address some of the complexities that can come up in the world of medical billing and to account for the potentially conflicting interests of patients, insurers, and providers. Plaintiffs take issue with three details of the regulations that the departments issued pursuant to that statutory mandate. But plaintiffs' arguments pluck isolated words from the text, deprive it of its context, and conflict with the very text on which they rely. Not to mention conflicting with Congress's purpose of reining in increasing healthcare costs to patients and consumers, as the amicus brief on behalf of patient and consumer advocacy organizations explains quite well. On the remedial issue, in Trump versus CASA, the Supreme Court recently put a stop to the practice of reflexive universal injunctions, which many district courts had formed a habit of entering as a matter of course in cases involving the executive branch. This case presents the related question whether the Administrative Procedure Act created the functionally similar remedy of authorizing every district court in the country to purport to erase regulations universally. The practical problems with universal vacatur are similar, and as Justice Gorsuch recognized in his concurrence in United States versus Texas, there are powerful reasons to think that the best interpretation of the statute Congress actually enacted in 1946 did not upend centuries of tradition regarding party-centered relief. As we've explained in our brief, when you do take a fresh look at the APA using all the standard tools of statutory interpretation, the best reading is that Congress didn't create a new system of vacatur. But even if it did, Congress certainly did not speak clearly enough to create a system where, contrary to bedrock principles of equity, every district judge in the country is supposed to grant relief to non-parties by default and consider more limited relief only in exceptional circumstances. That gets the default exactly backwards. I welcome the court's questions. And I'm happy to start on the merits points since there are three of them. So the first one on the question, what rates are supposed to be included in the so-called ghost rates issue. I think the text of the statute is quite clear when you look at the phrase as a whole, that Congress was not trying to create a distinct requirement that insurers, when calculating this number, would need to look to the claims that were paid or to the services that were performed over some statutorily undefined period, which is what plaintiffs are asking you to read into the single word provided. When you zoom out and look at the phrase as a whole that it's used in, and this is at page A3 of the addendum to the government's opening brief, you have the language of the statute, you'll see just that particular part says that is provided by a provider in the same or similar specialty and provided in the geographic region in which the item or service is furnished, consistent with the methodology established by the secretary. And it's, I think, provided by the provider is a quite natural way to just link the two limitations that appear right after that, the geographic region and same or similar specialty, to the thing the QPA is actually supposed to be, which is the median of contracted rates. I don't think that Congress was saying that when you look at your rates that an insurer has negotiated in advance through an arm's length negotiation with the providers, that you were supposed to exclude certain of those rates. It was saying that you were supposed to group them, both by
Mr. Sutter, can you reconcile your reading that provided means make available with your 2022 FAQ that states that the QPA may include contracted rates for other services a provider does not provide?
So that was, I think, talking about how the same or similar specialty formulation works, and I think some unclear language and guidance can't override the fact that the statute was not calling for the kind of inquiry that the plaintiffs are asking for. There's nothing in the statute that tells you you are supposed to go look at historical data about when a particular service was in fact furnished, which is what I think you would need to do in order to accept their reading of this statute. So I acknowledge that there's some imprecise language there, but what it's getting at, I think, is the point that is entirely consistent with the regulations, which is when you have, for example, if you come across a contract for where an anesthesiologist has agreed to provide dermatological services, you're not going to end up calculating a QPA for dermatological services by dermatologists that includes that because you're doing it separately by specialty, and that's the point that was getting across.
Well, counsel, even doing it by specialties creates situations. Amicus briefs mention it, plaintiffs mentioned it in their briefing, which you have broad specialties, OBGYN, orthopedists, others, who don't actually provide all OBGYN services, never would. Don't provide all orthopedic services, never would. It's not that the statute doesn't have language that says you have to look at historical data, other than the word provided. And so if that service provider does not provide half OBGYN services, half orthopedic services, just looking at it in terms of specialties wouldn't take care of the problem if the argument is correct factually that a specialist wouldn't worry about service codes, service levels that they don't provide, and those contract rates may be artificially low. They wouldn't be zero because you've taken care of that, but they may be artificially low. Is that a factual issue of whether that actually has happened, or are you strictly rejecting that as a matter of statutory interpretation?
I think the question is one of statutory interpretation, and it's whether, in order for the situation Your Honor is talking about to come up, you would have to have a situation where a provider has agreed to a contracted rate for a particular service that is within that provider's specialty, but is nonetheless not a service that that provider somehow subjectively expects to perform over some unclear period. And I think what Congress was imagining in the statute when it tied the statute to contracted rates, to the median of the contracted rates under the plan, was that you would be able to look at the four corners of the plans and tell from that, okay, this provider has agreed to accept this rate for this service. That's going to be the rate that we use for the QPA to determine how much the patient pays. But then Congress determined that's not going to necessarily be the only thing that drives what the provider gets paid, because it created this entire arbitration and negotiation scheme where a provider could come in and say, that amount is not reflective of the value of my particular services. I'm happy to move on to the second merits issue,
Just to clarify on the first, is your argument against including what are called ghost rates in the QPA some or all of the following? That they are provided as in they're available, they are provided because they're on the fee scale that everybody can negotiate, dispute, and remove, and or is it because the statutory regime understands that the providers have the best knowledge, incentive, and time to challenge them?
I think it's all three of those. Now, this is looking to rates that were agreed to in the past before the No Surprises Act, because I think Congress was concerned about the incentives it would create if you could come up with these contracts after the fact. And I think one statutory clue that's very helpful for all of these points that we haven't talked about yet is that the statute says to look at contracted rates recognized on January 31, 2019. And I think that makes quite clear what Congress had in mind was exactly what the departments did, which is to say, insurers, go look at all of your plan contracts, do this calculation, line them up within specialty and within geographic region, and then pick the median of that. And as America's health insurance plans have told you in their amicus brief, that process, which Congress built in 6 months for, already cost $1 million per insurer that had to do it, adding up to about $1.7 billion total. And the plaintiffs are here asking you to require this calculation to be completely redone in a way that those same amici are telling you is essentially not possible to do at all and significantly more expensive. And so moving on to the bonus and incentive value-based payment issue, I think there, too, it's helpful to look at the amicus briefs from the insurers that explain better than I could how this actually works in practice. But the basic idea of this part of the regulation is that the types of payments that the providers are asking you to say need to be included in the QPA are rarely actually tied to a particular service. So when we're talking about a median of the rates contracted on a fee-for-service basis, these are generally not going to be fee-for-service payments. And what Congress did is it recognized there are all these complexities in the medical billing world, it recognized that there are all of these competing interests, and it left it expressly to the departments to figure out how that works. And what the departments did was they came up with a methodology where they said, okay, if you have some fee-for-service rate table, even though you have some other ways of paying for bundled payments, look to that fee-for-service rate table. If you don't have that, maybe you have an accounting methodology you use for tax purposes or something, do that. What it didn't say was include these separate, often after-the-fact lump sum bonus payments, which makes sense because it also said you don't include the kind of counterpart to that, which is penalty payments. I think fundamentally what the plaintiffs are asking you to do is to read this statute as if it says that the QPA is supposed to treat each provider as if it's the best possible provider getting all of the incentives available to it under the plan, rather than as if it's the provider that gets...
May I ask you a question about the language of this provision? There are two sentences. The first one says, and this is the one the appellees focus on, such rulemaking shall take into account payments made by such plan that are not on a fee-for-service basis. The next sentence says, such methodology, which is referring back to the methodology to determine the QPA, such methodology may account for relevant payment adjustments regarding account quality or facility type. What is the interaction of those two sentences?
So the first one, I think, is the more directly applicable to what we're talking about here, which is where Congress was saying the methodology that's developed under this rulemaking must figure out some way, and Congress left it to the department's discretion to figure out what that way would be of dealing with fee-for-service, or sorry, non-fee-for-service arrangements in general. That second sentence, I think, was serving to add that Congress wanted to give particular discretion in this area of essentially
low-income and rural type.
I think so, but those are more on the, I think, like the facility basis. And here we're talking about payments for particular providers, but that does get back to, I think, the more the problem that the department's recognized when crafting this rule is that a lot of these bonus and incentive payments, in addition to being lump sums that are either an addition or a penalty on the back end, aren't just going to correspond in any particular way to a service from a particular medical provider to a particular patient, because they may even be made to the facility or to the provider.
This is sort of my problem with the appellant's argument, and I'm not taking a position at this point, but did this law contemplate using a snapshot of January 31, 2019?
Yes.
And that being the case, under the appellant's reasoning, you'd look at any provision for retrospective payments, you know, non-fee-for-service payments. Is that right?
So you'd look at the plan contracts that existed on that date, and you'd look to see what is the fee-for-service that's been agreed to for this particular service. In a standard fee-for-service arrangement, that would be fairly straightforward. In one of these more complicated situations, the departments explained that you have to do this thing where you figure out Either there might be a fee-for-service table that's in there, even if the provider is being paid in some different way. There might also be instead sort of an accounting methodology that's used. But none of that ties a particular bonus, incentive, or penalty payment to a given medical service. And I think Congress was looking to understand or to give a starting point for the determinative point for what the patients would pay and a piece of the puzzle in what the insurer would pay. It wanted just a sense of what's the median in-network rate, and it doesn't make sense to say that the median in-network rate should be determined by assuming that every single provider would be the best possible version of performing under that contract with the plan. I'm happy
also, there are arguments in the briefing that the panel gave too much discretion to the agency, and to some extent you're talking about that now. This is complicated business. How are these contracts actually formulated? To what extent can you defend what the panel held, which I'm not sure defending it here, we need to work with it, under Loper-Bright? To what extent was it a Chevron decision with a bow towards Loper-Bright? It seems to me you're really arguing here that for us to interpret in the way that plaintiffs want us to interpret what provided means would require enormous expense getting beyond proper interpretation of the word provided. But I think you are bleeding into really saying that we need to rely on the discretion of the departments to tell us that this is too hard if we interpret provided in a way that arguably is a better interpretation, which you have to look at whether that provider is actually going to ever make that service available.
So I think, of course, the panel did have the benefit of Loper-Bright and explained why its reasoning was consistent with Loper-Bright. And what the Supreme Court has made clear in that case, as well as its subsequent case that we cite in the brief, the Seven County case, is that the court's role is certainly to decide statutory interpretation questions for itself and to fix the bounds of an agency's authority and ensure that it's acting within those bounds. But there are going to be many situations, including the one addressed in the Seven County case, where the dispute comes down to what the plaintiff is really trying to say is that the agency didn't engage in reasoned decision making within those bounds or did something that's not a reasonable use of its discretion. And so on the bonus and incentive issue that we were just talking about, I think there, once you recognize that the statute was not clearly precluding doing a fee-for-service calculation by actually looking at where the plan contract had tied the fee to a particular service and then was leaving it to the departments to fill out the details of the non-fee-for-service arrangements, I think that is a helpful framework for thinking about that issue. On the provided issue that Your Honor was talking about, certainly it's the court's role to give meaning to the statute, but I think when you look at the statutory provision as a whole and look at its context and look at the purpose that it's serving in this statute, it's just really not tenable to come away with the conclusion that Congress was hiding within this one word, provided, an unstated requirement that you would look to whether providers had furnished services over some period that is, again, not stated anywhere in the statute. I think it's kind of unusual to be here thinking under the plaintiff's view. I'm a little bit more worried about what I would be saying if we had done a rule that the plaintiffs are asking for, because we would be talking about a hypothetical rule that involves looking to some unstated statutory period over which claims were made or under which services were furnished. And I think that is a further departure from the statute and than anything else.
Well, and I want to note, I do think Loper-Bright makes it clear that the Congress may be giving the agency very little or quite a bit of discretion from statute to statute. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes.
And isn't it your understanding that this one does give a fair amount of discretion, which is different from maybe some other statute that Congress may pass?
Yes, and it's different from other parts of this statute. As the panel decision explained, there was a difference between the arguments that we were making at the panel stage about the QPA methodology, where Congress did really put this in the hands of the departments quite clearly, saying the departments shall establish a methodology, and the statutory definition of the QPA says it has to be consistent with the methodology developed by the departments. I think that is a wider range of latitude than some of the other issues that have come up in this litigation. And of course, the panel resolved a different issue on that basis as well.
So we're in direct review, of course, of the district court judgment now that there's no panel opinion. What is your wish list in terms, as the appellant, in terms of specifically what you're asking us to do in regard to the district court's judgment?
So as we set out in our brief, I think on the merits, there are three things that should be done to the district court's judgment, all of which involve the QPA calculation. And it's reversing the district court's judgment on all three of the QPA calculations that issues addressed in our opening brief. The third of which we haven't talked about yet, is the air ambulance provider argument that one-off out-of-network arrangements are supposed to be included in this calculation of the median in-network rate. That one, I think the court has to address, even though no further review was sought on that issue, because the panel opinion has been vacated and you're reviewing a district court judgment that has set aside that portion of the regulations. And then on remedy, which I'm happy to talk about further, I think that the court's role is to determine what remedy would be appropriate for any provisions that are left unlawful after this court's disposition of the merits, which involves remedy for both the issues that we're not here talking about the merits of, as well as if the court rules against us on the merits of any of these QPA calculation issues, the court would necessarily have to reach the question of what remedy is authorized by the Administrative Procedure Act, as well as how the equities could justify the relief that was entered by the district court here.
With regard to remedy, this court had stated as recently as 2023 en banc in the Cargill case that universal vacatur is the APA's default remedy. But you're asking us to do something different, and I have a follow-up question. What other remedy could redress petitioners' injuries, given that insurers are not parties here, and it's reminiscent of the corner post concurrence that Justice Kavanaugh has written? Can you elaborate on that some, please?
Of course. So first on Cargill, I think what the court said in Cargill was that the remedial scope issue was not briefed there, and so the court wasn't going to revisit its precedents. Of course, this is a quite different situation where you have full briefing from both parties as well as amici on the remedial scope question. On what sort of relief would be possible here, I think we're just asking the court to ensure that district courts are asking the right question. We're not asking the court to resolve that question in this case in the first instance. And the right question to be asking is what equitable remedy would be appropriate to redress these plaintiffs' injury in a manner that's consistent with the tradition of equity in this country. And our submission is that the APA did not sanction a radical departure from the tradition of equity that the Supreme Court just explained in its CASA decision. I think Justice Gorsuch's concurrence in United States versus Texas really spells out how these are of a piece with each other. And of course, he was joined there by two other justices, so there is this ongoing discussion among the Supreme Court justices, and we're just asking this court to take a careful look at the text structure, context, history of the APA, and resolve these two important questions. One, whether vacatur is an authorized remedy at all, and two, even if it is, how you would evaluate whether to award it.
Counsel, related to that, just with diminishing time left, if you don't prevail statutorily, are you asking us to remand without vacatur? And if you are, what's the best case that explains when a court does that for the nation as distinct from issuing a universal vacatur? If the decision you're going to describe to me keys it on disruption, does this record show that striking the QPA calculations will be disruptive to Americans?
Yes, it does show that. And I think, as we talked about, I think the cost of recalculating the QPAs would exceed $1.7 billion. And as the administrative record and the rulemaking makes clear.
Do you have a sort of record site, or is that it's in the brief?
That's, the insurers are the ones who are calculating that. It's in the America's Health Insurance Plans amicus brief, and I think they have a better sense of this. They estimated it, that the first time around it cost about $1 million per insurer, and that when you add all that up,
And just quickly, what's the best case? I know several that we have chosen to do remand without vacatur. Other circuits have too. Of course, we have authority to issue a universal vacatur. What's the best circuit decision that explains when a court will choose one or the other?
I think this court's decisions that we've asked the court to take a closer look at what the way that the default rule should work. I think there's a Southwest Utility decision that explains the factors that the court looks at, but I just want to make clear our submission here is that you shouldn't apply the sort of thumb on the scale in favor of universal vacatur. That's putting a thumb on the scale in favor of the exact thing that the Supreme Court just said is a problem in the very similar context of universal injunctions.
If a vacatur were granted, what would be the practical consequences for ongoing payment of out-of-network providers?
So if the district court's decision were affirmed on both the merits and the remedy, right. I think we would then be in a world where some of these regulations have apparently been erased, even though there is no history of erasing regulations. You don't erase statutes when you find them unconstitutional.
I understand that. I'm asking practically speaking.
And I think practically speaking, insurers would have to go back and figure out how to calculate QPAs consistent with what remains of the regulations. And the departments would have to figure out whether new regulations are necessary, which is...
So, in other words, payments to providers might well have to be suspended pending the recalculation or the reissuance of a rule and then the recalculations?
So what's been happening is that the departments have exercised their enforcement discretion to say insurers are supposed to calculate a QPA that's consistent with the methodology established by regulation. The government has enforcement authority if they are not doing that, and the government has recognized that in light of the costs and time that it would take to recalculate this number and the uncertainty that surrounded this litigation, for the time being, insurers can continue using the numbers that they calculated under the original methodology. But I think if there were a final decision making clear that that original methodology is not going to stand, there would be a different discussion of what happens next.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jillian Stonecipher on behalf of Appellees Texas Medical Association, Tyler Regional Hospital, and Dr. Adam Corley. I'll be speaking to the provided and total maximum issues along with remedial issues, and Mr. Strauss will speak to the separate single case agreements issue raised by LifeNet and the other air ambulance providers. The departments have no discretion to craft a methodology that is inconsistent with the text of the No Surprises Act that Congress enacted. They have even less authority to enact a methodology that is inconsistent with the text in ways that will forever depress QPAs below negotiated market rates, resulting in inadequate compensation for emergency and other providers. That's not what Congress did in the text it enacted, and has always been the case. And it's even more clear after Loper-Bright, Congress has to stay within the statute. The departments have to stay within the statutory bounds. The departments try to complicate issues here largely by raising administrative concerns. But administrative inconvenience can never override plain statutory text. The Supreme Court said exactly that recently in Corner Post. Even if it could, even if administrability concerns were at play here and had a role in our statutory interpretation, the administrative inconvenience caused by these incorrectly calculated QPAs vastly outweighs any inconvenience in taking the time to get the QPAs right. This is a statute that will affect provider compensation forever, and it was reasonable for Congress to require the work to exclude junk rates and to include negotiated for bonus amounts. Judge Kernodle recognized that the statutory text here is clear and simple, and that so are the department's violations. So what are those violations? First, as to provided, the NSA says twice that every rate that goes into a QPA calculation has to be for an item or service provided. provided by a provider in the same or similar specialty, and provided in the geographic region. The departments want to read that term out. But they've told insurers that when they calculate QPAs, they should include rates for items and services that, quote, providers do not provide. The government is here saying that that's unclear language, but it's not unclear. It's not unclear. That's what they have said in the guidance that they issued that is binding on insurers. And there's no dispute that under that guidance, insurers are calculating QPAs to include rates for items and services that providers cannot, would not, and are not even equipped to furnish to patients. Under the plain meaning of provided, that decides the issue. Second, on total maximum, the NSA commands that every rate that goes in must be the total maximum payment under the contract for an item or service. But the departments are telling insurers they have to subtract. Calculate your contracted rates, they say, and then subtract, exclude any amount that is incentive-based. The departments are here saying, well, not all bonuses are for items and services. But that's really beside the point, because their rule tells insurers to always subtract. Whether or not the bonus is for an item or service, under their rule, the bonus is excluded. That is contrary to the text of the NSA. Third, even if Congress had not been clear here in the text that it chose, it was arbitrary and capricious for the departments to enact rules that depress QPAs in this way, without so much as acknowledging what they were doing. An important aspect of the problem Congress addressed in the NSA was adequate provider compensation, which makes sense because they radically changed the marketplace in which these providers operate. It is not rational for the departments to require insurers to exclude negotiated bonus for amounts and to tell insurers to include junk rates, meaningless deflated junk rates, in QPA calculations without even addressing the way that this deflates provider compensation. Finally, the departments invite the court to take a U-turn from its well-reasoned precedent on remedies under the APA. There's no reason for the court to do that here, both because those precedents are correct and agreed with by every court in the country to address the question, and because the departments have never come forward with any narrower remedy that could provide any relief here. Even today, Justice, one of you asked the departments, what is the remedy? What is the narrower remedy that you propose? The departments don't have one. It would be unfair to remand this to Judge Kernodle to consider something that the departments never placed before him. I welcome the court's questions.
I also have a question about, let me posit that the only problem with the methodology, once you eliminate zero rates in a contract, once you eliminate specialties other than the specialty that you're focused on, if those rates are different or than in the specialty. It seems to me your argument is that an awful lot of these specialties will have in their contracts rates for things that are never provided. I don't think it was your brief, but one of the amicus briefs did some data, I don't know if it's the Avalari study or what it was, 60-some-odd percent of providers in a certain discipline may only provide a certain service twice. Well, twice is enough. It's provided. So it seems to me that the premise for your question, for your position, if, in fact, the only problem is, you don't have to acknowledge it, but just go with me on this. If the only problem is on, at the specialty level, the contracts will include rates for things that plan will never actually pay for because that specialist will never provide it. What is the evidence to support that the rates in those contracts are, in fact, not negotiated in some way or artificially low? They can't be zero because they would be eliminated for that basis. What would we go on to cause what I think everybody would acknowledge, and you can tell me otherwise, is going to be a very disruptive situation if we vacate this methodology? What would satisfy the court if the judge has only that problem with the methodology, that this actually is a problem?
There is evidence in the record that this is a problem. I think the best evidence is the FAQs themselves, where the departments acknowledge that this is a common way in which insurance contracts are negotiated, that the insurers include a full fee schedule of every item and service that they cover in each individual provider contract without regard to what that provider actually does. There are also declarations in the record from the plaintiffs here talking about the fact that there are non-zero ghost rates that are appearing in contracts. But I think the main problem here is that reading same or similar specialty to render the provided requirement meaningless doesn't work as a matter of statutory interpretation. Congress chose each word in this QPA definition, and each word has meaning. It chose to require that the item or service be provided by a provider in the same or similar specialty. And so it is not a correct reading of the statute to find that same or similar specialty alone addresses the rate. We don't guess at what Congress meant when it chose this language. Congress chose the language, and we give effect to
it. Well, excuse me, counsel, I'm talking about statutory interpretation, though. It does seem to me that the study I was talking about that said some providers might provide a particular service only once or only twice. But that does still mean it's available, even if it hasn't been provided that one time yet. Now, I guess I'm just wondering, how can the methodology account for that without some sort of global assumptions?
I agree with you that some of the data is about that. The Avalier study does also look at rates that providers never provide as well as ones they plan to provide a few times. But to the extent that you're worried about, sorry, could you ask the question one more time? I think I lost track of what you were asking there.
I lost track too.
I guess I'm picking up on that. In your brief at page 12, you quote the QPA, but you leave out entirely the in the same or similar specialty. So that's not a textual reading. That's not clear and simple. You leave it out entirely. And so I guess my question is, once you put the language Congress put back in, it sounds like it's made available as to actual. If you have to look to whether others in the same area, same specialty, that's not an actually provides, that's others make it available. So my trouble was in the brief, you kept leaving it out entirely to argue it's provided by a provider. But if you put it in, it sounds like you have to look whether it is available by other providers.
I think you have to look to both because that's what the statute says. And to be clear, we're not arguing for a historically furnished test. We think we clearly win under available because okay. Available has a plain meaning too. This court discussed it in Green Valley Special Utility District where it talked about when a service is made available. And the court found in that case, a service is available if the person providing the service has it at hand, is able to provide it, has the equipment to furnish that service to someone. The department's rule is different. They say anytime it appears in a contract, it is available, but that is not what available means. Just like in Green Valley Special Utility District, how a legal obligation to provide a service didn't mean the service was actually available, the fact that a rate appears in a contract does not mean that that service is actually available. And in fact, we know that it's not. The departments recognize that when a rate is in a contract, that does not mean that the item or service is available. And well, if you look at the statutory text as well, you know, Congress made clear that that's different. If provided can't mean in a contract because the departments start, the Congress started with contracted rates. So we look to whether the contract.
But if they never provide the issue, then the patient will never have to pay for it. So I'm not understanding why if the entity is never going to do X, we need to worry about what X would cost.
Well, exactly. We think that they shouldn't worry about so.
But I mean, why are you all worrying about it?
We're worrying about it because under the department's rule, all of these rates for items and services that providers do not provide, meaning do not make available at all, are getting factored into the QPA calculation. So the QPA is the median of this set of rates. And some of those rates, undisputedly, are junk rates. They're rates that no one thought about, no one negotiated. Insurers provide fee schedules.
Well, if there is some specific problem some specific entity has, can't that entity deal with the agency? I guess I'm just having trouble with why you all are going off on something that doesn't seem like it's likely to come up.
This comes up in every single case under the NSA, because in every case there's a QPA.
I understand the QPA, but what I'm trying to say is this just seems like something y'all are addressing that is really not the main issue in all of this.
It is very important that the QPA approximate negotiated market rates as closely as possible, and the way that Congress chose to do that was through the statutory text. Each provider showing up to IDR or negotiation requesting payment for a service is confronted by this QPA that the insurer comes for. The insurer calculates in private, in secret, and comes forward with.
Well,
says this is the median.
May I ask you a question about the January 31, 2019? One of the amicus briefs pointed out that some services are provided on that date, some services are not. What is the point of taking a snapshot of contracts and then trying to, as I understand what you're saying, apply these, you may have one practice that does a certain kind of anesthesiology and rarely another, I forget what the examples are, head and neck or something, but there's an item in the contract for that. But as of January 31, 2019, there weren't claims for that. So how do you arrange a median based on the happenstance of what was occurring on January 31, 2019?
We think the significance of that date is that it identifies the relevant contracts. So those are the contracts at issue, those are the rates that we're starting with and then narrowing down from. The provided requirement is a separate requirement that will require insurers to look outside the four corners of their agreement to determine whether that item or service for which there was a rate in January 2019 is something that provider provided, as in made available, furnished, or supplied at that time.
Right, but my understanding, again, to get back to what I was talking about, I just want to be maybe a little clearer. My understanding on the provide is that you can provide it, not that you have, but that you can. So if you could not, then it wouldn't be part of that in y'all's entity, right?
Well, under the department's view, it would. Under the department's view, the simple
I thought
fact
they said provide means that it can be provided, not that it has been.
No, they make clear in their reply brief here that their view is that any time a contracted rate appears in a contract, that means available.
That's because why would it be in the contract if you can't provide it?
Because that's how this works. Because this is how this works in insurer-provider contracting, as the departments recognized in their FAQs. They said in negotiating these contracts, insurers currently, or in 2019, they would come to a provider with a 20-page fee schedule of every type of service they provide with their kind of opening offer. Their low rate that they would pay for that service. Providers negotiate just the rates that they provide. And then they return the schedule, and that whole schedule goes into the contract. So there are tons of junk rates floating around out there that are not negotiated, that are not reflective of the negotiated market value of the service.
Counsel, I think Judge Haynes is The discussion you're having with her is really getting at the key to the case for me, which is what you're saying is that these so-called junk rates or ghost rates, if they're included in the calculation, then it's dragging down the QPA. That's why you don't like it. That's why your clients don't like it, right? It's dragging it down. Isn't that the point?
That's exactly the point.
Okay, that's what I thought.
How do you tell if there are these rates dragging down, you It's my understanding that you argue while the department's excluded any zero rates from the QPA, rates that are artificially low are still considered part of the calculation, and that's your position. But how would you propose that the department determine that the rates are artificially low? Because it seems that that would require the department to determine which rates each provider has negotiated with insurance companies and separate those from rates that haven't yet been negotiated.
Yeah.
And is that right? Are you saying they have to go through each one and separate them out from rates that haven't yet been negotiated?
I think that they do need to do the work to figure out whether something was provided. The statute doesn't say negotiated, it says provided. And so they need to go back to that term of provided.
And when do you define provided? January 31, 2019, whatever year is covered by 2019, a few months,
what meant? The statute makes the relevant time that January of 2019. But the departments are tasked with creating a methodology to give effect to that statutory text. So I think there are reasonable ways they could do this. One, for example, the departments could set some kind of time period under which, if there's data that a item or service was furnished, if there's claims data, that is enough, the rate goes in. They can look to their own claims data. Blue Cross Blue Shield says they have data for 40% of Americans. If they still have questions about what rates were provided in that time period, they also have access to additional data. They go through a credentialing process with every provider that they have a contract with.
Well, that already exists, so that's not, I don't think that, well, but moving on, I mean, I do think what you're talking about in the statute, what you would like, is something that's going to be incredibly complex. And moving to the next issue, which is the non-fee rates that are frequently incorporated into these contracts, how do you apportion a bonus payment or a quality payment that is retrospective in nature back to providers of particular services?
Yeah, so that's another administrability concern that the departments are raising and that they never considered below. I think in a lot of cases it's really easy, given the way that the contracts are structured. In fact, their amicus that is supporting them points to their Blue Cross Blue Shield's brief discusses a report by the Healthcare Payment Learning and Action Network. They say it doesn't show that anything is allocated on a per service basis, but if you look at the report, it says under category 2C, providers may receive higher updates to their fee-for-service baseline, or they may receive a percent increase on all claims paid, depending on whether they meet quality goals. So that's an adjustment on the face of the contract to the fee-for-service rate.
Does that benefit the patient? If there's an adjustment, if there's retrospective adjustment, will the patient get a rebate?
So the patient's cost sharing here would be calculated based on the QPA. The QPA is based on 2019 data. So
I understand that, but what I'm saying is, if the calculation of this, I'm confused, but the calculation of the retrospective increase, was that something that went into the amount that a patient was charged originally?
The departments say that customarily that's not the case, that the patient's cost sharing amount is determined at or near the time of service, whereas the retrospective payment may be made later in the year. Congress didn't take any of that into account. It didn't make any of that matter.
So basically the patient would be paying more, and then the QPA for the physician would be higher.
That's not necessarily the case. The patient's cost sharing is calculated in kind of a complicated, in different ways, depending on the plan that the patient has with their insurer. So that their cost sharing will be capped in the same way that it would be capped under their plan. So if they have met their deductible, if they've reached their...
Well, we understand deductibles. Yeah.
So in many cases, the QPA actually won't matter at all for what the patient is paying. In some cases, it may, including the bonus amount in the QPA, may result in them paying a slightly higher amount. Say they have a 10% coinsurance obligation, they would pay 10% of the QPA. So whatever amount the QPA is increased by the bonus would, they'd pay that slightly higher amount. But Congress didn't say, Congress considered all of the issues and it didn't say that the amount that goes into these calculations is the total maximum that minimizes the patient's cost-sharing obligations. They said the total maximum, including all amounts that are paid by the insurer.
Counsel, this dialogue moves me thinking to relief, because when I went back to read the April 23 hearing, the attorney for TMA on this issue, the risk that Americans would end up getting hit hardest, did say, we think the departments could allow the insurers to continue using the existing QPAs until such time as compliant QPAs can be recalculated. To me, that sounds like TMA admitting the risk to Americans is enough that it should be a remand without vacatur. Do you disagree? And if you disagree with that statement made by the TMA attorney to the district court, do you disagree factually with the suggestion that the record would show this would be disruptive, whether or not it would lead to higher cost sharing by patients?
I don't think that that's what the counsel for TMA was meant to say, was that this would be very disruptive for Americans. I think what he meant to say is that it would be disruptive to not...
No, I'm just talking about relief. We think the departments could allow the insurers to continue using existing QPAs until such time as compliant QPAs can be recalculated.
Yeah,
that sounds like
that.
Don't vacate, remand, but don't vacate. Let them keep using the existing. Am I wrong?
I think that's a different question. I think that the argument there is not that that you should not remand without vacatur, but that there will be a timely, orderly process through which insurers can recalculate. If you remand without vacatur, there's no incentive, as there is in every case, there's no incentive for the departments to issue new rules for insurers to ever begin recalculating correct QPAs. That would be bad. So we need the rule to be vacated so that insurers start recalculating and start using correct QPAs
What's
in a reasonable
rule,
time.
Though?
Was
What's
that?
The interim rule before there is a recalculation?
While the recalculation is ongoing, the departments can continue using their enforcement discretion. They've said already that they've extended it through February of next year and that they may extend it through August. We think that would be a reasonable time to allow for an orderly and non-disruptive transition. But we think that remand without vacatur just results in continued application.
Are you suggesting a recalculation later, sort of a balancing of the books at some point? Is that the plan?
The plan is that once assuming this court affirms Judge Kernodle's decision to vacate, the rule will be eliminated, the unlawful parts of the rule will be eliminated, and insurers will begin to recalculate QPAs. Hopefully, the departments will issue guidance, they'll help them along in doing that the correct way, issue a final rule that helps them with that recalculation. If not, insurers will recalculate consistent with the statute. That has to happen anyway. There are other rules that the departments are not even defending on the merits that will require QPAs to be recalculated once that vacatur is affirmed. And in terms of the question I've heard raised a few times about the supposed $1.7 billion cost, there is no remedy that would not require a recalculation of the QPAs. Even if there were some kind of plaintiff-specific remedy available, that would still require insurers to recalculate the full set of QPAs.
Thank you, Ms. Stonecipher. We have your argument. Mr. Strauss?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Max Strauss, and on behalf of the Air Ambulance Plaintiffs, I ask the court to affirm vacatur of the second sentence of 45 CFR 149.140A1. And that regulation excluded single case agreements from the calculation of the QPA, by stating that a single case agreement does not constitute a contract. I welcome the court's questions, but absent them, plan to address 3 points this morning. First, single case agreements are contracts that set rates for air ambulance services. Second, those rates were recognized under health plans and on January 31st, 2019. And third, neither defendants nor amici's policy-based arguments have support or can override the plain statutory text. So first, turning to the plain meaning of contracted rates. Defendants concede on reply at pages 24 and 29 that single case agreements are contracts, yet their regulation says precisely the opposite. That alone should justify affirmance. A rate, moreover, contrary to defendants' position, includes the price paid for a single item or service. In fact, that's exactly how the No Surprises Act uses the term rate. It refers repeatedly to the out-of-network rate for a single air ambulance transport, for example, in 300GG112A3B, as well as 300GG11A3K, and elsewhere in the statute. Now, that usage is entirely consistent both with the dictionary definition cited in our brief and common parlance. I negotiated a flat rate of $25 for repairs to my bike. My friend has a cheap health insurance rate. Turning to the second point, single case agreements set rates recognized under a plan and on January 31st, 2019. Now, the departments say that whether a plan permits case-specific agreements is an entirely separate question from whether those agreements are recognized under a plan, but it's not. The departments admitted in their opening brief that under means subject to, pursuant to, or under the authority of, and single case agreements are entered subject or pursuant to and under the authority of plans. If they weren't, plan administrators would act ultra vires every single time they tried to enter a contract for a single case agreement, and plans would be prohibited from covering out-of-network care. In the reply, the defendants also offered a second argument with respect to under, pointing to their conclusion in the preamble. They say that contracted rates must be set under the generally applicable terms of a plan to count for the QPA. Now, that argument's not only circular, it's also atextual. The No Surprises Act doesn't say that the rates that count are those recognized under a plan's generally applicable terms. Instead, the No Surprises Act says that the rates that count are those recognized under such plans. Meanwhile, any doubts about which single case agreements are recognized on January 31st, 2019 can't justify excluding them entirely. And the court doesn't have to determine as part of this appeal exactly what that term means. It's something that can be addressed finally for the first time when the rule goes back to the agencies and they can go through notice and comment rulemaking, something they still haven't done. But there are some possibilities that come to mind and which I would expect proposers to submit to the agencies at that time. One is that that term reflects contracts entered into on that date, or prior to that date, but not yet paid. I would also expect commenters to submit proposals. The term refers to the highest rate contracted with a provider as of that date, given the statute's mandate that the QPA reflect the total maximum payment recognized under the plan as of January 31st, 2019. Now, third, the department's policy-based arguments are unsupported and contrary to the text, and I just want to home in on two of them. First, the departments have claimed they're trying to protect the patients from higher QPAs, and Judge Jones, you asked some questions about this with respect to patient copays. Now, with respect to air ambulance services, the QPA doesn't even determine patient copays. It's not in the statute. The departments opted to do that, and they can change their approach on remand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of points on the merits, and then I'd like to briefly touch on remedy again. On the merits, I think when you look at the scheme as a whole and look at who has interests in this, I think Congress recognized that the departments would use their expertise and their ability to take into account the interests of not just the providers like the plaintiffs here, but also patients and consumers in devising a QPA methodology.
Can you respond to what Ms. Stonecipher said in response to me about provider, that she was saying y'all were just like, yeah, regardless. But isn't it, don't they have to be able to provide even if they haven't provided?
So I think it's helpful if we just step back and look at the full statutory definition. And I apologize in advance. I think it might be helpful to read it once, but it's a lot of words, and I think Congress recognized this is a complicated area. And I'm going to skip a couple of those words. But if you look at page A3 of our addendum, the definition of the QPA is that it should be the median of the contracted rates recognized by the planner issuer respectively as the total maximum payment including the cost-sharing amount imposed for such item or service and the amount to be paid by the plan or issuer, respectively, under such plans or coverage, respectively, on January 31, 2019, for the same or similar service that is provided by a provider in the same or similar specialty and provided in the geographic region within the item within which the item is furnished, consistent with the methodology established by the Secretary under paragraph 2B. Plaintiffs are hinging an awful lot on the word provider in there, which, as we've discussed, is really just a natural way to link what this median is supposed to be taken of, which is the contracted rates that you can see
right.
on the
and
plans
if they,
that are in effect.
If this is not in their arena, it wouldn't be in the contract, right?
Certainly, yes. I think that what the statute contemplates.
So my point was that it can be provided, but she acted like that's not what you're saying. You're just throwing it out.
I think what we're saying is that there is no further inquiry that the insurer is supposed to do when it has an agreed upon rate that a provider has agreed to accept for a particular service within that provider's specialty. You do not make the insurer do an inquiry that I still haven't heard an articulation of how this is possible. And I heard the statement that the departments are trying to make this more complex. I mean, the plaintiffs do not have an answer for how you would determine how an insurer is supposed to determine.
Well, I don't want to go on and on, but I just want to say, if this is just not in their arena, it would not be in the contract, so it would not be part of the QPA. Right?
I agree that it's not particularly, I'm not sure if, I mean, there might be circumstances where a provider agrees to accept a rate for a service that they don't expect to perform, but that provider might nonetheless perform it. And the point, I think, is that when the insurer
That's
is looking through the contracts, they can use the rates, they can use the tables that are in the contract. They don't have to figure out what I think I heard my friend on the other side say, is that a service is only provided if the provider is equipped to furnish it. I have no idea how an insurer is supposed to figure out when they're looking at a contract dated January 31, 2019 with a provider for a service within that provider's specialty, they're supposed to somehow figure out after the fact, 6 years later now, whether that provider was equipped to furnish that particular item or service?
May I ask you, we're focused sort of specifically on emergency services, right?
It's emergency services, and then it's also if you go to an in-network facility,
right.
Have a surgery, like, and you get to see an out-of-network anesthesiologist.
Well, suppose you have an OBGYN, and we know some obstetricians deliver babies, gynecologists often do not deliver babies, but do various things. If you have a typical contract for OBGYN, it will include a whole bunch of services that the doctor, although certified for OBGYN, will not perform.
I think plaintiff's assertion is that that is very frequent. I think what the departments actually noted in the FAQ statement is that it came to their attention that this sometimes happens. And as Your Honor's original point noted, this is primarily in the emergency medicine context, and in the emergency medicine context, you may well have many situations where an emergency medicine doctor has agreed to rates for services that they don't expect to provide, but an emergency comes up and they provide it notwithstanding their expectation of not providing it, and then the reverse happens. Go ahead.
Just quickly, before your time's up, states legislate against surprise billing as well. Do you happen to know if there's any insightful case law? In other words, have they built on the federal language that's being attacked here?
I'm not aware of case law on that particular issue. I do think, just sort of zooming out, I guess I would encourage the court to look at the statutory language as a whole.
Is there record support for the proposition that the rates are artificially depressed? What is the actual rates and any particular examples in the record?
I think plaintiffs are pointing to a sub-regulatory guidance document in which the departments noted that it comes to their attention that this happens sometimes. That is the same guidance document in which the department said, if you have a placeholder rate of zero in there, everyone agrees that's not a negotiated rate. But the departments explained the same or similar specialty requirement takes care of the concern that there may be rates that, even though they appear in a contract between a provider and an insurer for services within that provider's specialty, that is a contracted rate, and Congress wanted the median of the rates.
But isn't it also true that there have been many, many times more requests for arbitration under this regulation than were even anticipated?
Yes, the system has certainly...
So that indicates it's a lot of unhappiness.
I don't know which way that cuts in this particular case. I think you have a situation where Congress was hoping for there to be a workable system, and one way in which the system could be made far less workable in a way that would be very costly to patients. And of course, this does come down to when an insurer pays more. The administrative record and the legislative history is clear. Insurers pass those costs right on to patients in terms of increased premiums. And we're talking here about a situation where a handful of providers have come in and said the whole system needs to be blown up. Every single insurer in the country, which I think the record site on that would be, if you look at the Rule 86 Federal Register at 36927, it mentions that there are about 1,758 entities that have to calculate this number. And that's where the amici get the cost of $1.7 billion, is saying that it's going
to
cost a million each.
We have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate all the arguments in this case. This case is submitted. The en banc court will stand in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m.